When you need to refuel between meetings or running errands, or you just want a healthy snack that squashes your hunger, Wonderful Pistachios, which come in a variety of flavors and sizes, by the way, are the perfect choice to fill you up and keep you going throughout the day. Wonderful Pistachios is also a good source of protein and a zero-guilt snack. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, guys, which gives you over 10% of your daily value. And with flavors like salt and pepper, sweet chili, and seasoned salt in the shelled variety, options like chili roasted, sea salt, and vinegar or jalapeno lime in the no-shell variety, you're sure to please your taste buds while snacking healthy. So check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey guys, I know we're all working so hard to stay fit and healthy at home. So check out my app. I have free daily 7-minute workouts. Download the app. It's Jillian Michaels Fitness app. Download it. Do the 7-minute workouts. You don't need any equipment. There's total body workouts, ab workouts, leg workouts. You get a new one every single day. And if you want more, obviously, there's a heck of a lot more in the app. There's over 1,000 different exercises. All of my DVD workouts are in the app. I can customize a workout for you in the app. There's freaking yoga, kickboxing, HIIT training, outdoor runs, bodyweight training, free weights. There are thousands of recipes, no matter what your diet preferences are. But at the very least, please do the 7-minute workouts for free. Welcome, everybody, to Keeping It Real. Pretty excited about the show today, Cindy. Pretty excited.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have a very special guest, someone whose work I've been following for over a decade. He is a theoretical physicist, mathematician, and a string theorist. His name is Brian Green, and I've talked about him many times over the years. And this guy is, he's just a true inspiration. He's like Einstein, Hawking kind of genius, this guy. And I mean, I have almost all of his books, and what's so great about him is that you can actually understand.
Yeah.
You can actually understand his books. So like I bought The Universe in a Nutshell and A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. But I mean, dude, I went over them and over them and over them and over them. And like, and I couldn't fully, and I mean, I would worship at the feet of Stephen Hawking. If he were alive today, I would die to meet him. But I found his explanation still often above my head. You know what I mean?
For scientists.
Yeah, it's like, you're just like,
for physicists.
Wait, what? You know, you're just trying to kind of, your brain can't get past go. And with Brian Green, he's even, I think the Washington Post said that he was arguably the most capable human being in the world at explaining these sort of very complex scientific realms of, you know, the universe, reality, the cosmos, in a way that you know, people like you and me can understand. And, you know, I find it fascinating that these guys really do have a window into the mind of God. In my opinion, the mind of God. I am a believer. I don't know. I think I fall under the agnostic category. Forgive me if I get this wrong, and that I believe, but I don't know exactly. It doesn't have a concrete, like, oh, this is God. Yeah. And I respect all religions, and I think all religions are just a path to God, right? For me, my bias would be science, which sounds counterintuitive because you think, well, isn't science, you know, there to deny the existence of God? But I would argue the opposite, even against the scientists, even against the scientists, because I'm gonna give you an example.
Okay,
Cindy, we're gonna do a little exercise.
I'm ready.
It's called Schrodinger's cat. So this was what's called a thought experiment by a colleague of Einstein's named Erwin Schrodinger. I think it was from 1935. So here we go. Cindy, you've got a cat in a box, right? I'm going to make it super simple. And there's a device in this box that could randomly be triggered or not. And if it is triggered, it releases poison and kills the cat. Okay, so the cat's in the box. There's a device in the box that could or could not go off. It has to do with a decaying atom, but we don't even need to get into that. Bottom line is, could go off, could have not gone off. It's a 50-50 shot, right, that the cat's dead or alive in the box. Cindy, did it go off or not? Right now, the cat's in the box. Is the cat dead or is the cat alive? The cat is both dead and alive. Because according to the math, all potential realities can slash do exist until something interacts or observes it. So now we lift up the box, right? And arguably both potential realities can play out. So in one parallel universe, the cat is alive. And in one parallel universe, in the opposite universe, the cat is dead. And there's a lot of science to suggest that this is 100% possible. In which case, Cindy, when you woke up in the morning, right, and you made a decision that could have gone either way, right? Do I go for coffee this morning? I don't know. Maybe I'll just make it at the house. Do I make it at home? Do I make it in the house? Ah, fuck it. I'll make it at home. And in another reality, you went and you got it to go from Starbucks. If Starbucks was open when COVID didn't exist, which in another parallel universe, arguably it might not. Here's why I find this so fascinating. Because just this little bit of knowledge to me, in a world that is so inherently unfair, I think to myself, my God, like if everything happens, if the pauper is a prince in another universe, right? And the prince is a pauper, is this possible? I mean, it could make sense to me. Like, what is our journey here? To know ourselves, to evolve, to grow. How do we do that? By playing things out and learning from them. If you arguably play out every potential scenario, would you not eventually become all-knowing? Like, this is always my path to spirituality, directly or indirectly. And some of the things we're going to be talking about today with Brian are, you know, touch upon the potential of immortality. I mean, if time is potentially a location on the fabric of space-time, then you and I will always exist on that location. What if past, present, and future don't actually exist? And it is all arguably now, according to Einstein. Like, these things sound crazy to us, and we're like, ah, you lose me. But what if you don't need to even understand it? What if someone else understands it and just tells you, no, this is what we know based on the math? I mean, imagine that. There's no such thing as a past, present, or future. It's all existing simultaneously. What does that mean? So with no further ado, I think I should stop talking. I think I should just introduce Brian Greene. So we're going to take a break and we will come back with one of the gentlemen I believe to be one of the greatest minds of our time. I've heard people say that as they age, they start to see it in their face or feel it in their bones. And then you've got creams that claim they'll give you younger looking skin or energy shots that'll give you youthful energy. I mean, but let's look deeper beneath the surface, right? On how we counteract the effects of aging. Well, True Niagen helps us age better by supporting the energy generating engines that exist in our bodies, helping us restore youthful energy. Tiny repair enzymes work deep in your cells to help you recover from lifestyle routines that are hard on the body, including sleep deprivation, an intense workout, a poor diet. True Niagen supports these enzymes. True Niagen is safety tested and backed by Nobel Prize winning scientists. Age smarter with True Niagen. And right now, new customers can save $20 on a 3-month supply by going to trueniagen.com and entering the promo code Jillian at checkout. Go TRUNIAGEN.com and use the promo code Jillian at checkout to save $20 on your first 3-month supply. TrueNiagen.com, promo code Jillian. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration, and this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I think we should all try at least one new thing in 2021. I mean, what do you think? Is everybody with me? And I'm going to make it easy for you.
check out Skillshare. It's an online learning community, and they've got thousands of classes to choose from. I mean, here's one that looks perfect for me since we're basically just talking about it on the show. Find Your Style, 5 exercises to unlock your creative identity, and it's taught by Andy J. Pizza. It's all about translating your taste into what you make and experimenting to develop your visual vocabulary. Skillshare has so much to explore. You can work on real projects with the support of fellow creatives and bring some fun to your year. Plus, it's incredibly affordable. An annual subscription is less than $10 a month. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/Jillian and get a free trial of premium membership. That's Skillshare.com/Jillian, Skillshare.com/Jillian.
All right, we are back with our much anticipated guest, Brian Greene, who is a theoretical physicist, mathematician, and string theorist. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right, so first off, I would like to know if you could explain to people what a theoretical physicist is. And I say this only because I have said those words to people so many times and they just look at you and they kind of glaze over and they don't, I don't think they understand the nature of what means and what you do.
Yeah, well, physicists are a group of individuals who are trying to understand the inner workings of nature, the inner workings of the universe, from black holes to stars to planets to atoms to subatomic particles, trying to figure out the basic laws that allow everything to tick forward in time. Theoretical physicists like myself are the ones that, for the most part, use mathematics to try to do that. There are experimental physicists who build the big machines or the big telescopes and gather data and from that try to figure out insights into the world. We focus more on the equations.
Can I ask you how you got into this? I watched an interview where you talked about literally trying to grab the reins of reality. And I just thought, all right, how does a person even believe that can be done, let alone try to do it? So I was wondering, when in your life you were like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to know the mind of God. Like, when? How does that happen? At what age? And what inspired you?
Well, things always are less grandiose than they seem and more impactful later on than they seemed at the moment. So I remember I was at my desk taking my first real physics class. I was in high school. I was already kind of a math kid, so that was the direction I was going. But the teacher set us a problem, a very simple problem. There's a baseball attached by chewing gum to the ceiling. And you let the ball go and it swings back and forth. And the chewing gum stretches as the ball swings back and forth like a grandfather clock, like a pendulum. And it was up to the student to figure out the actual trajectory of the swinging chewing gum baseball. And it's not that hard a problem, it turns out. And I sat down and I solved it. And I looked at the answer and I was so enthralled that just by sitting at my desk, no experiment, no nothing, I didn't have to get any chewing gum, no baseball, just by using mathematics, I could figure this out. I ran down the hall to my dad. He was a composer, vocal coach, he wasn't a mathematician, but I showed him this mathematical answer. I described the problem as I just did. And somewhere in that moment, it just struck me how powerful math is. And that's really what set me on the trajectory that I've been on since.
You speak about how powerful it is. And I was telling my girlfriend, I was like, I'm so excited. I've been obsessed with this guy. I have all of his books. And she's like, baby, you know, the math thing. And I was like, honey, it's not the math thing. It's what these guys are doing with math and what it actually means and what they're actually unraveling. And I go back to, and I think it was, and I wanted to be sure I didn't get this totally wrong, but I believe it was Hawking that said that, you know, if you could understand the theory of everything, you could potentially have a window into the mind of God. Or Einstein said something very similar, to know the mind of God. I was wondering, do you believe in a God as in more than just this? Because I know a lot of quantum mechanics suggests it might not be possible. Or if so, what does that mean to you? Do you see that kind of magic? Because when I read your books, to me, it's very much like a church because you are explaining the magic of the universe, in my opinion.
Well, it's a good question, and it's a hard question. I firmly believe, and I can't prove this, but I firmly believe that reality is totally composed of stuff, particles, governed by physical law that we articulate for the time being in this language of mathematics.
Right.
And that's it. You don't need anything else. That, to me, lays out the ingredients for yielding the reality that we inhabit. Now, when some people hear that, they feel diminished by it, as if the magic has gone away, because there's got to be something more. There's got to be the soul. There's got to be other forces out there in the cosmos. And my view is that this view adds the magic. Why? It adds the magic because how utterly miraculous that particles governed by physical law can come together into structures like ourselves and think and feel and reflect and wonder and experience all that we experience. And it's just particles governed by mathematical laws. To me, that makes it more wondrous, more magical than to say, oh, and then God had to inject the human spirit, had to blow the human spirit into the nostrils of humankind. That to me would take away from the wonder of it all, because now there's some mysterious other that we don't understand, and that's where the magic comes from. How wonderful that you don't need that, as far as I know. The magic just comes from the way stuff comes together.
Okay, so then, how could you explain, arguably, how did these laws of nature come into existence? It sometimes feels to me like a computer program, like somebody programmed the math. Yeah. Or is it just random by chance that everything has worked out?
I don't know is the answer to that question. And I've puzzled about this, and my colleagues have puzzled about it. We continue to puzzle about it. Is it the case that somehow the universe itself has such an inner logic that it would be internally paradoxical, internally inconsistent for the mathematical laws not to exist? Might it be that the structure is just so exquisitely interlocked that if you move any one piece this way or that, the whole structure would fall apart? That would be one potential answer. The answer would be things are the way they are and the laws are the way they are because they could not have been otherwise. There is no other possibility. That would be a beautiful answer, but we are nowhere near being able to draw that kind of a conclusion. So some people have gone completely the other direction. They said, look, we can't explain the question that you just asked. We can't explain why these particular laws are the laws. So maybe there are many universes, each with a different set of laws. And maybe there's so many universes that every possible law is realized somewhere out there. And we just happen to be in one of those universes that happens to have these particular laws. It's like, you know, if you go to a clothing store, if you go to your favorite clothing shop and you're looking for a shirt. Let's say I'm going looking for a shirt. I'm not surprised when they have my size. Why? They've got basically all sizes. So why should I be surprised if they have my size? However, if it was a weird store that only had like one size of every shirt and they just happened to have my size, that would be like, wow, miraculous. But so you see the two extremes that you can look
yes.
at. And we don't know which is right. I mean, to imagine other universes, that's a radical leap. That's a radical change in our perspective of reality, to imagine that we're sort of one bubble in a big cosmic bubble bath of other universes. That is an idea that people take seriously, but others feel that it is stretching the boundary of science to imagine things that we can't observe, can't see, because they're part of reality, but beyond our grasp.
Okay, speaking of parallel universes then, isn't there, I believe there are four different types, but one...
Depends how you count, yeah, but...
Rick!
In a book I wrote some years ago called The Hidden Reality, I think I characterize as many as 9 different types, but it all depends how you categorize things.
Okay. Is there not one that you guys have arguably proven with the dual slit experiment? And I was wondering if you could explain what that actually is to the listeners and what it potentially could mean.
Yeah. Well, the answer to the question depends who you're interviewing. There are people.
Come on, really? How?
Yes, sure.
But yeah, the answer's
so
the answer.
Very quickly, just a little bit of background. So the double slit experiment is the prototypical experiment of quantum mechanics. That's the experiment where quantum mechanics was really established to be the new rules, the new laws governing the microscopic realm. And these laws have as their strangest quality that they only predict the probability of getting one or another outcome in any experiment. The laws of Isaac Newton from the late 1600s, those laws were, hey, tell me how things are now, and I've got these laws, and I'll tell you how things are going to be tomorrow. But the new quantum laws say that was misguided. The real way that the world works is by this elaborate game of quantum mechanical chance, quantum mechanical probability. So what do you do with these probabilities is the question. If I, for instance, there's a 50% chance that an electron will be here and a 50% chance that it will be over here. When you measure the electron, you don't find it sort of half here and half there. You find it either here or over there. Here. And the question was, if you find it here, what happened to the other possibility? Now, you might say, well, like it went away, 50% chance of rain. If it doesn't rain, the possibility of rain, it just doesn't happen. It goes away. But weirdly enough, the math of quantum mechanics, as we understand it, forbids the other possibility from just going away. So people said, well, if it doesn't go away, maybe it happens. People say, well, we didn't see it happen. We found the electron here. They said, well, it happened in another universe. And there was another one of you in that other universe that found the electron at the other location. So one of you found it here and another of you found it there.
There. But you have proof of that, no? Because I thought
depends on who you interview. Yeah. So there are people who would say that this version, I should say, of quantum mechanics is proven. These are people like David Deutsch at Oxford, people like David Wallace, another eminent physicist, philosopher. But people like me are not convinced.
Really?
When I look at the mathematics of this particular way of describing quantum mechanics, there are aspects that I feel have yet to really be developed to the point that they're convincing.
Okay.
And so you might say, so what's my version of quantum mechanics if it's not that one? What happens to the other possibility? Well, there are other proposals that people have put forward. There are proposals where you change the math of quantum mechanics, allowing the other possibility to really not happen, to just disappear, to be gone. That does require changing the mathematical equation somewhat, but in that we don't know what the right math necessarily is, who's to say that you shouldn't modify the equations in this way? So it's a vibrant debate that is alive and well in the field, and it hasn't yet been settled. Maybe in a few years it will.
See, I was under the impression that when we weren't observing the electron, it functioned differently than when we did.
And I would agree with that.
Okay. And that superposition means that electron was in multiple places at the same time.
I would sort of agree with that.
When you say sort of, what do you mean then?
Well, you see, we humans have an intuition about what it means for something to be at a given location, right? I mean, our forebears over the course of thousands of generations needed to have a conception of position, a conception of speed, so they get the next meal. Right? They had to know where to throw the spear to hit the antelope at a location. And they had to know the trajectory of the spear to get there. And those humans that did this well survived and passed on this intuition about physics, this intuition about basic qualities of position and speed to the next generation and the generations that followed. And when we use the language that you just did, which I use it too sometimes, to say that the electron is sort of at two locations at once, we're invoking that intuition about location. Whereas the quantum mechanical version of the story is a little bit different. The real way of saying it, and by the way, I use your language all the time, so don't get me wrong.
I'm a fitness trainer. I don't know the language. That's why we're talking to you.
Yeah, but it's good. That language is widely used, but just between us, the real way of saying it would be that before you look at the electron, it doesn't have a location. The very concept of location only comes into relevance when you look, when you undertake a measurement. And before you look, it's really better to say the electron simply doesn't have a location. Now, our brain rebels against that. Everything has a location. What does it mean something doesn't have a location? And that's the new mode of thinking that you really need to absorb if you're going to take the lessons of quantum mechanics to heart.
So it's dependent on the observer.
I would almost say yes to that too. Again, I often say that as well. The only qualification I would make to that is, if by observer you mean a human being with a consciousness,
yes.
I don't think that's the case.
Really?
I think that any kind of sufficient interaction with, say, the electron, it could be a photon does the observing. It could be an amoeba that does the observing. It doesn't have to be a conscious human being, as far as I know. Now, again, on these issues, there are some physicists that if you were to interview them, they would say, no. You need a consciousness. I don't see their arguments. I don't find their arguments convincing. And I'd say the majority of physicists would articulate a version of explanation that I just gave.
Okay. So another question on this, forgive me. I'm just trying to understand it. I was also under the impression that when a device was utilized to measure this electron, it subsequently behaved differently. And then I interpreted that to mean that on some level, something is conscious of being observed and something is changing the behavior of the electron. So is there anything to that device observing it? It was almost as though, in my interpretation of it, the electron was like, oh, you're watching me, got to fall into some sort of concrete reality now.
Yeah.
And that reality unfolds as we observe it, and that suddenly in this Schrodinger's cat world, the cat's dead, the cat's alive, and we split? Or are you saying you don't fully buy that then?
Well, again, it depends on the level of precision of language. I've often described the electron in these, you know, anthropomorphic terms, as if the electron has a mind and it knows that it's being observed and it says, wait a second, I'm being observed. I have to go from this fuzzy,
yes,
nebulous reality and I have to snap to attention and be at a definite spot. I use that language, but it's colorful language and it can be misleading language.
Okay.
Because as far as we know, at least as far as I know, consciousness is not essential to anything that we're talking about. It's a particle, it's interacted by some other particle or collection of particles, and that's all there is to it.
Period.
Now here's the thing. You can come back at this and say, but wait a second, how do you know that the electron's been measured? I say, well, you know, that device did the measurement. And the person says, but how do you know it was a successful measurement? I say, well, I looked at the dial. They said, you looked. How did you know? Well, my consciousness came to bear. They say, your consciousness. They can then say it didn't have those qualities until you brought your consciousness to bear on the situation. I don't buy that, but there's no way that I can get outside my own head. There's no way that I can know something about the world without my consciousness being part of the process. And for that reason, we're caught in a bit of a loop here, because even though my understanding is that we don't need consciousness, I can't argue it without consciousness, because I can't know anything, I can't observe anything until my consciousness is part of the story.
Obviously, I have more questions for you, but we're going to take a quick break. And we'll be right back with theoretical physicist Brian Green.
How many of you have had the same sheets for an eternity? And you've never really liked them, but you just keep putting them back on the bed? Well, stop. Brooklinen can make those bad sheets go away. And they don't only have sheets, they also have comforters, pillows, towels, loungewear, and more. I actually have Brooklinen sheets and towels, and I love them. Brooklinen was started by a couple who couldn't find beautiful home essentials that didn't cost them an arm and a leg. And what they wanted to do was start a company so everyone could have luxury without luxury level prices. It's 2021. Do something nice for yourself to start out the new year. And to help you do that, Brooklinen has a special offer. Go to brooklinen.com and use the promo code Jillian to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping. That's brooklinen.com. Enter the promo code Jillian to get $25 off when you spend $100 or more, plus free shipping. brooklinen.com, promo code Jillian at checkout. All right, you guys already know Third Love is my favorite bra ever because it's so comfortable and fits me awesome. But did you know that they give you 60 days to see if you love your new bra? And if you don't, you can return it or exchange it for free. Third Love actually donates all their gently used return bras to women in need. And so far, they're up to 40 million in donated bras. I mean, that's incredible. Not sure about your size? Take Third Love's online fit finder quiz. It's a few simple questions to find a style and size that fits your shape and your body. 2021 is time to focus on what makes you happy. So why not start with better bras and underwear? Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering my listeners 20% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/Jillian now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/Jillian for 20% off today. thirdlove.com/Jillian.
All right, we are back with theoretical physicist, mathematician, and string theorist Brian Greene. Moving on to this one. The nature of time. For those of us who are just cruising around our daily life, time seems to be moment to moment, unfolding moment to moment, and we make decisions in the moment, and it affects the outcome of what has yet to be. But when I watch you talk about time and this fabric of space-time and time being a dimension almost as though it's a coordinate, then is there really, there is no such thing as the past, present, and future then. Do we know that? Or well, am I misperceiving that as well?
No, well, at the level of each individual, there is a notion of their past. And there is a notion of their future. Each individual can organize the events that make up their lives into those categories. But Einstein famously said that past, present, and future, that distinction between them is only an illusion, however persistent. And what Einstein meant by that was that different observers will have different conceptions of past, present, and future. So my past might be your future if we are moving relative to each other in the right way. Your present might be my past if we are moving relative to each other in the right manner. And since no observational vantage point is special, better than any other observational vantage point, Einstein put forward the view that we shouldn't think of this demarcation into past, present, and future as somehow being intrinsic. It's not. It differs depending on the different individuals, and therefore, in some sense, it's all as real. Every moment is as real as every other because any given moment is somebody's now, somewhere in the universe, based on how they're moving and the gravity they're experiencing.
So then it does all unfold, arguably, simultaneously, all already exists, like a movie that's already been shot, and we move through it frame by frame.
In a classical world, if we put quantum mechanics to the side for just a moment, in a classical universe, that would absolutely be the correct description. Everything in the so-called future is fully determined by the past, and therefore it all just is, as opposed to somehow there being some uncertainty or some volitional choice, some free will that we humans are able to exert. So in a classical world, those ideas simply go away. The idea of free will completely gone. And for some, that's a distressing thought. And they've turned to quantum mechanics. They say, well, wait a second.
I do everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it that I've made every choice then, instead of like, I wasn't able to make the actual choice, it was chosen for me. But if I have an infinite amount of realities, I make every single choice.
Now, in a sense, you're not free either then, because you're forced by the laws of physics to make every choice. I mean, the idea, at least the intuitive notion of free will that most of us have, is you're faced with a variety of possible choices and you pick one. And that choice, that's your freedom. Now, if you somehow pick all of them, then you've lost your freedom too. Moreover, I would say that quantum mechanics is largely irrelevant when it comes to the question of human freedom. Because the only new feature that quantum mechanics gives us over the classical world is what we spoke about before, namely, you can only predict the probability of one or another outcome. You can't nail it down completely the way you can in the classical world. But whatever happens, either there are many universes, as you're saying, or if there's one universe, it's a probabilistic choice that somehow is made. And we don't know the details of that, but probability, a random flip of a coin, that's also not what we mean by human freedom. If somebody told you that all your decisions behind the scenes were chosen because somebody was flipping a coin, and if it came up heads, you were forced to go left, and it came out tails, you were forced to go right, you wouldn't feel free.
No.
Randomness is not freedom. So I don't see how quantum mechanics, however much people love to fall back on it in trying to resurrect free will, I think it's irrelevant. We just have to accept that we do not have the kind of free will that our intuition tells us we have.
I've often thought of it from I only say spiritual perspective because it's the only way I know how to perceive it when I don't understand the math like you do. But if that was a possibility, in losing my free will, I took a piece in thinking, those lives that are so brief, right? Or in a world that seems so unfair, I thought, well, you know what? In an infinite number of realities, that individual will get to be the king, will get to be, to live 100 years, will die at 5, will, and maybe it's this knowing, this desire to know every possible outcome. Maybe there's a greater learning in that, but it has brought a fairness to it in my mind, if it should exist, which might be a fantasy, right? It's just life is unfair. Bad crap happens to good people. But I would be willing to give up the free will if it meant that inevitably somewhere it's fair. It all evened out, which sounds like it's probably bullshit. And just like...
Well, saying it's bullshit would be too strong, because again, there are physicists that you could talk to who would sit here and say you are absolutely right. That is how the larger landscape of reality does look, in that sense of, you know, leveling the playing field, because everything out there that could happen does happen somewhere. Yeah, I mean, there may be something to that. As I was saying before, though, I am far from convinced that that picture is correct. And I have to say, I feel like I have a deep spiritual outlook on the world, but one that is within the constraints of a physicist's understanding of how the world is put together. I mean, to look at the world, the fact of the matter is the universe is under no constraint to be fair. Fairness is a human construct that we come up with, and it's a valuable one and a valiant one. But the particles governed by natural law, they're impervious to these issues of freedom and good and bad and evil and wonder. They just do what they're going to do under the guidance of Schrodinger's equation, as you mentioned before, of quantum mechanics. And so the fact of the matter is, the particles don't have any intrinsic conception of fairness. They just do what they're going to do.
Here's how I have often thought of this. If the past, present, and the future are always there, right? So to speak, on this fabric of space-time, in this dimension of time, then in essence, I'm never really gone. None of us are ever really gone. We just might not exist on one piece of this fabric. Just like I'm not in London right now, I'm in LA. I might not be in 2300, but 2000 always exists, and I'm always there. Am I just as alive always as a person in 2300 and a person in 3000 BC? Or is this, again, just another fantasy, or is that magic
possible? No, I fully agree with that. That, as far as we know, is the way reality works. Your life consists of a certain collection of events that take place at a certain collection of moments. Those moments don't change. There's no conception of a moment in time being subject to change. Change is a temporal notion, and moments as being the fundamental unit of time, they themselves can't change. Change only occurs when you compare things at one moment to a different moment, but the moments themselves are immutable. So yes, there is a sense in which every moment that you have lived, you are still part of that moment, and you will be for eternity, because that moment will never change.
When you look at the nine apparently parallel universes that you describe, are there any that are more probable to you? Like, if we were to actually buy into one other, number two, right? If we're in this one, anything outside of this one, the remaining eight, which would that be to you that would be more, I don't know if even real is the right word. And what does that potentially look like? Even though we can't grasp it, understand it, know it ever in this reality.
Well, I think one of the best motivated versions or flavors of the multiverse comes from our understanding of the Big Bang, our understanding of how our universe got started. And there's a theory, it's called inflation. You actually briefly mentioned it as we were talking a moment ago. And it's this idea that in the early universe, we went through a stage of rapid expansion, driven by a certain kind of cosmic fuel. It has a technical name. It's called the inflaton field, but the names don't matter so much. But this fuel drove repulsive gravity, an outward push that we believe is the origin of the Big Bang. Now, when we study that theory mathematically, we find that it is virtually impossible to ever fully use up the fuel. So some of the fuel drove our Big Bang, but some was left over, and the remaining fuel would have driven another Big Bang, and some would still be left over, and that would have driven another Big Bang, and so forth. So you wind up getting a grand collection of distinct universes, each emerging from this outward thrust, this repulsive gravity of this fuel. And so our universe and its Big Bang would just be one of many, many universes created by many, many Big Bangs. And those other universes, some could be like us, some could be different. The fundamental laws of physics would be the same, but the details, the qualities within them could be highly dependent on contingent factors, the initial conditions, how things actually started to expand in one universe versus another. So some of those universes might have people, some might not, some might have other kinds of life, some would be completely barren of life entirely.
Speaking of, I'm going to take a little hard right here and ask you, given that the universe is expanding, continuing to expand, as you mentioned, it wouldn't necessarily be infinite then if it is currently expanding, right?
Not necessarily. It could be infinite. And that's a weird idea, because you hear expanding, it seems like it's getting bigger.
Yeah, like
something's
it has a boundary infinite. End.
Yeah, right. And so the way to think about it is that imagine that the universe does go on infinitely far. So its overall size can't get any bigger. We've maxed out. It's infinite, right? But now within that universe, consider the distance between two galaxies. Their distance can grow over time. And two other galaxies, their distance can grow over time. So the expansion would not refer to the overall size, which is already infinite, but would refer to all distances growing larger over time.
I have to believe that if there's an infinite amount of galaxies that have infinite amount of stars, and the Fermi paradox, right? And X amount of those stars have planets. Surely we cannot be alone here. That would be an absurd concept.
Yeah.
Would it not?
In an infinite universe, then you can argue pretty convincingly under the most modest assumptions that there has to be other life out there. But the mathematical argument only establishes the other life at fantastically huge distances.
Right.
And so we would still be alone in any sense of being able to communicate, have a conversation, because this other life would be so far away. In fact, yeah, you know, it's even weirder than that. If you follow the math in an infinite universe, you can prove that there actually are copies of us out there. If you go,
wow, I have seen you say this, but I couldn't even grasp it enough to ask you about it. You're telling me that in universe A, I can exist multiple times.
Yeah.
How does the math tell you that?
Well, you see, well, you have to buy into one assumption that you may not buy into. You have to buy into the assumption that you are nothing but a collection of particles in a very specific arrangement that's iconic to you. And I'm just another collection of particles in another arrangement iconic to me. I believe that that's all that we are. Particles, as I was saying before, governed by fundamental forces. But just run with me for a moment. Buy into that for argument's sake. If you consider the number of distinct arrangements of particles, you can prove, under, again, modest assumptions, that there are only finitely many distinct arrangements of particles that are possible. And so if the universe goes on infinitely far, the particle arrangements have got to repeat because there aren't enough different arrangements to go around.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, you know, the analogy that I like to use is if I have a deck of cards, they're in some random order and I shuffle them, the order changes. But you know that if I shuffle them
enough times
sooner or later, the order has to repeat because there are only finitely many orders. Similarly for the particles, they have got to repeat in an infinite universe.
So then the particles might arrange themselves as Jillian or Brian,
yep.
But Brian and Jillian's reality could be fundamentally different.
Yes, that is possible too.
But couldn't we only exist on this planet as well, though, right? Because we've adapted to Earth. So then we would have to exist on Earth somewhere.
Well,
a planet
there
with
would
this
be
gravity.
Well, you can even go further. You can actually prove that not only the particle arrangement repeats, but the entire history of that particle arrangement also repeats. And therefore, you're right. There may be Jillians out there whose reality is very different from yours, even though that Jillian looks like you and sounds like you and so forth. But you can also prove that there are other Jillians out there whose entire life history matches yours identically.
What do you do with this information in your head, Brian? Like, I'm serious. Like, what do you do with that? What does that mean to you? Like, for you to say this to me, like my human brain obviously is just like, just can't get it. I mean, I hear you and I understand exactly. And that's why, you know, you are not only one of the best at what you do, but one of the best at explaining what you do. But quite honestly, what keeps Brian Green up at night? What part of this makes your brain just explode?
These ideas certainly are among the top few. Now, they're also highly speculative in the sense that we don't know that the universe goes on infinitely far. So the ideas that sort of blow my mind more are the ones that we've already confirmed, like the existence of black holes. I mean, that's a crazy idea. It emerges from Einstein's math way back in 1916. Einstein doesn't believe it, even though it comes out of his own equations. And then you fast forward till today. Well, this year, the Nobel Prize is awarded to Roger Penrose for mathematical insights into black holes, Andrea Ghez for observing a black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And I'm sure you saw the photograph a couple years ago from the Event Horizon Telescope, an actual radio telescope photo of a black hole in the galaxy M87, 55 million light years away. So that's the kind of thing that blows my mind, that you can start with equations and push them forward, gain insights from the math. It's like with the baseball and the chewing gum, and then you go out into the real world and it actually works. Wow. You know, that's the stuff that is so deeply inspiring.
I know we only have you for a few more minutes and you're extremely busy, but speaking on black holes for a second, essentially, a star is imploding, right? It's collapsing in on itself and punching a hole in the fabric of space-time. Is that what's happening there?
in some sense, we don't really know what happens. We don't fully know what happens right at the center where that singularity, that hole would be. So that's still an open question, but that's not a bad description.
So it's sucking everything in. Where the hell is it going?
Yeah,
and I've heard Hawking radiation, but I don't understand what that means. Does that mean like it's spitting out at some sort of radiation? Like when it sucks in a planet, is that gone forever? I don't get it.
That is the $64,000 question, to use the old reference, which now sounds like too paltry a sum to be worthy of our attention. But that's the one that people are struggling with today. Does the stuff, the information contained in the stuff, ultimately come back out, or is it somehow removed from the universe? See, what Stephen Hawking
found. Could it
go into
another universe? Could it be another Big Bang somewhere else?
Some have suggested that the center of a black hole might be a Big Bang for another universe, in some sense, on the other side. People have suggested that. Stephen Hawking himself established that black holes are not fully black when you include quantum physics, that radiation can ooze slowly out of their surface. And
that's
that gave
Hawking
rise
radiation.
To the possibility. That's the Hawking radiation. And that gave rise to the possibility that maybe the information of all stuff that falls in somehow seeps out over time. At first, Stephen Hawking did not think that the information could get out. He really thought it was utterly destroyed. Toward the end of his life, he's changed his mind. And we string theorists have long argued that the information does get out. But the details of that are very much forefront research today. There are arguments, debates, papers on this subject every day now. So this is still far from fully settled. We think that when stuff falls into the black hole, it does get pulled toward the center and it gets crushed to...
There is a center?
Yeah, the center weirdly... It's not a location in space. It's actually a moment in time, you see, because space and time interchange their roles when you go over the edge of a black hole. So one reason why something can't escape a black hole is the same reason why if I said to you, hey, Julian, could you just stay at this moment? Just hang on to this moment. Don't go forward in time. You'd like, well, I can't help it. I can't stay at this moment. I've got to go to the next moment. I've got no choice. Similarly, when something falls over the edge of a black hole, heading toward the center is going toward the future. It can't not head toward the future, just like you can't not head toward the future. When it gets to the center, it's a kind of end of time. It can't go any further forward in time, and that's where its journey ends. But the question then is, does all that stuff somehow then slowly seep out if you wait even longer? And we believe the answer is yes, although no one can fully prove that today.
So you believe it seeps out back into this universe?
Yes, into this universe. Yeah.
All right, I know I'm about at my time here. What is next for Brian Greene? Is this it?
Well, I would say the big question for me is, what is the true nature of time? I mean, you and I spoke a little bit about some of the weirdnesses of time, you know, past, present, and future being very much a personal as opposed to objective description of the world. But I want to know, is there a realm of reality where there's no notion of time? Is time a kind of higher level concept that only comes into existence in certain realms of reality, but there are other realms where the concept evaporates, doesn't even have any role, doesn't even have any meaning? Is that possible? Is there some sort of basic ingredient of time, just like there are basic ingredients of tables and chairs, you know, molecules and atoms? Are there molecules and atoms of time itself? That's a question I'd love to one day know the answer to.
Well, when you do, I'll definitely be reading that book. And speaking of your books, which would you recommend people start with?
Well, if someone wants to go really in the hardcore science direction, you can start with The Elegant Universe, the first book that I wrote. If one wants to go in the more science, you know, humanist direction, trying to know what this stuff means for us as human beings, then my latest book, Until the End of Time, would be a good place to start.
And for all things Brian Greene, website?
Yeah, I have a website. I don't do much with it any longer.
You're busy?
Yeah, I don't. The World Science Festival is this nonprofit that has all these programs on science for general audiences. That's a good place to check out. I have a lot of discussions there with leading scientists on every scientific subject under the sun. So worldsciencefestival.com is a good place to go.
Brian, you're truly an inspiration. Thank you so much for your time. And
well, thank you.
I hope that we'll get you back in the not too distant future. And I
That'd
look forward to the future answers that you uncover and trying to understand them and apply them to my life. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys, we want you to subscribe to the podcast so you can stay up to date with our life-changing and life-saving information. So on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you're listening, click that subscribe button.